Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax, the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast. We're your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me, as always, is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, Merry Christmas.
Ho, 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 ho. It's December.
Oh, it's so exciting. It's so exciting. Finally, none of you can stop me.
That's right. Everyone has to embrace and accept it, that it is, in fact, the Christmas season. And Chris, we're in the spirit of giving. It is the time of giving.
Yeah, sure.
And we're in the spirit of giving. And what we're giving you, the listeners, is a very fun interview, not too long from now, with Tom Fowler, who has a great new book and a Kickstarter for his tabletop gaming art. The book is called D&D&D, Dungeons and Dragons and Doodles. It's a really cool book. You should go contribute to the Kickstarter. We're going to talk to him somewhat about that, maybe more about Canadian TV.
That's right, Matt. So what do you say we go ahead and get started with our first officially Christmas-themed episode of the season?
That's right.
And get some business out of the way.
Yes, before we do anything else, we should thank all the people who are helping us out.
That's right, Matt. These are people who have gone over to patreon.com/warrocketajax to put a little presence in our stockings and help us keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills. And I gotta say, these are also people who are expecting me to draw a drawing for each episode of the show, which I am woefully behind on.
Hopefully we'll get there.
You'll find out why in our Checks and Recs segment.
We actually have missed a couple weeks of doing this, so hopefully I will go through and get everybody who has contributed in the past few weeks. If you feel as though you have been left out, let me know, and I will make sure to read out your name on the show. But here are some of our most recent contributors on Patreon. Ryan Bielek.
Well, thank you, Ryan.
Or it could be Bielek. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Ryan. Mark Bennett.
Thank you, Mark.
Al Kennedy, a name you may know from the Secret Convergence on Infinite Podcasts.
That's right. Good guy. Thank you, Al.
One of the hosts of the House to Astonish podcast, which is a really good podcast you should listen to. Eric Moore.
Oh, thank you, Eric.
Jordan Lurie.
Thank you, Jordan.
Alan Provan.
Thank you, Alan.
Helena Romelzio.
Thank you, Helena.
She has an umlaut in her name, and that is great.
That is rad as hell.
And those are our newest Patreon supporters. Thank you to all of them. I have been promising for weeks that we're going to be adding some Movie Fighters content to the Patreon. That is still going to be happening, but I don't think it's going to happen until the first of the year when I can really focus on it, because you know how things get at the holidays.
Sorry. Matt, I think we have a new guest on the show.
No, I just did a little bit of a crazy voice to hit that note. But once January rolls around, we will be adding some Movie Fighter stuff to the Patreon. In addition to a new goal, we'll also be adding some new rewards that involve Movie Fighters. So keep an eye out for those. Thank you to everybody who's supporting us. We really, really, really appreciate it. And I think we're going to maybe be having some new developments for the show in general in the year to come. So stay tuned for all of that. Chris, let's find out about the developments that are going on in our lives right now by doing some comforts and joys.
Oh, that's right. That is right. They are comforts and joys. So come on and jiggity-jack
yourself before you wreck yourself. All right, Chris, what's going on with you this week? What's keeping you comforted?
Here's what I'm checking into that it's keeping me in comfort. this week. Now, Matt, as you know, the Christmas season is upon us.
It is here.
And there's a thing that I've been talking about doing for years, but that Aiden and I finally, like, made the commitment to do it, which is that we put on our sweaters and went and had pictures taken to send out as Christmas cards.
Fantastic.
Now, we made an appointment of, like, 2 weeks in advance at the JCPenney Portrait Studio at the mall in Columbia. And I think we kind of expected that, you know, everyone has a camera now. You are most likely listening to this on a device that is also a camera, right?
whether it is a phone or a computer.
Yes.
There's a camera in that thing. Yeah.
So I kind of assumed that the JCPenney Portrait Studio would be similar to what you're probably thinking of when you think of a JCPenney, which is, like, I assumed it would be kind of dying, you know, like that it would be a mall thing that no one really did anymore. That is not the case. Like, JCPenney Portrait Studio was jumping.
I assume there were, like, at this time of year, that is the case. Like, because yes, everybody has a phone, but not everybody is a professional photographer and has lights and a studio to shoot pictures in. So unless you're making your Christmas card a posed photo that you took throughout some point throughout the year that you liked, you got to go to that studio. And where else is there a photography studio other than maybe, like, some independent photographer that does headshots, you know?
I mean, there is literally a portrait studio next door to my apartment. Like, I could walk 50 feet and be in a portrait studio. But also we were like, oh, no, we're going to the JCPenney Portrait Studio at the mall. Our appointment was for 12:20. Aiden actually just texted me this from the living room. Our appointment was at 12:20, and we got in around 1. Like, there was like a 40-minute wait because this place was slammed. People were getting pictures of, like, very obviously, like, new babies, like, two big families. Everyone was having, like, a really good time. And we're there, like, you know, two goofballs showing up in Christmas sweaters to do this ironically, which was great, but, like, only kind of ironically, like, kind of sincerely.
Yeah, it's not that ironic.
No, it's not. But, like, you know, we're clearly doing this, like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if we got JCPenney Portrait Studio pictures and sent them out as Christmas cards, but also it would be kind of awesome. Like, also it would be great. Long story short, I now have a membership at the JCPenney Portrait Studio, so I have no sitting fees for a year.
Nice. You're going to be getting so many portraits.
Oh, it was great. Like, there were, like, 5 or 6 people on staff. Our photographer was, like, a young lady who was obviously very into how into it we were, who was like, all right, what do you guys want to do? And I was like, oh, we have poses in mind. Like, there are pictures that exist of us, like, doing jumping high fives in front of a fake Christmas tree background, you know, wearing Christmas sweaters and Santa hats. So we did, in fact, pick out our Christmas card photos, and Matt, one of them will be winging its way towards you before too long, so look out for that. But yeah, folks, if you have not gotten out and gone to the portrait studio and getting some pictures taken, go do that. Like, make a day of it. It's fun. It's really, really fun.
Yeah, it sounds like quite an experience.
Matt, what is your comfort this week?
So, I have...
I'm sorry, I've just been corrected. We have a membership for 2 years.
Oh, 2 years.
Portrait Studio.
Man, they want people coming in there. Maybe that's why there's so many people there. They're locked into these, like, freebie sitting fee deals, and the people are like, if I don't go, I'm losing money.
You know? Actually the exact same price as the sitting fee for one session to get a membership for 2 years. I want to take Christmas card photos every month.
Yeah.
I did tell Aiden, I was like, we should like create a story over the next like 10 years of our Christmas card photos together. And she was like, Chris, that's what Christmas card photos are. They do tell a story over 10 years.
I
was like, okay, fair point.
You could do one. You could go get a picture every month and make a calendar.
Oh, I could. Okay. Patreon goal. $5,000 a month. Chris Sims, JCPenney Portrait Studio calendar.
It sounds great. Sounds so good.
Matt, what is your comfort this week?
I had a weird Thanksgiving experience a couple weeks ago where we had to go to an completely different place than first expected because my brother fell off a ladder and shattered his elbow.
Oh, no.
He like, completely, like, it was in pieces. And the thing that my sister-in-law told me that he said when he was, like, mega doped up on drugs, like, I think they gave him ketamine. And he was like, don't fuck around with ketamine.
Like, I don't think they give you ketamine. Like, that's Special K.
That's what he said it was. But he said something to my sister-in-law about, hey, I know they're probably going to put like a metal thing in my elbow and tell them that adamantium doesn't exist, so I'll take titanium. He wanted to make sure that the doctors knew that he couldn't have adamantium in his elbow, so he'll just have to have titanium instead.
That's good, because the doctors might not know that.
Yeah, they might go for adamantium. He might be in the Weapon X project. But we ended up going to my brother's house for Thanksgiving because instead of my mom's house, because he was, you know, having to sit in bed with his banged up elbow. And I like stood there talking to him about comics TV shows for a while. Like, I was talking about watching Jessica Jones, which I'll get to in a minute. And he was talking about having watched Powers, which is apparently available on Crackle now. And he said Powers is not that bad. But he said he was also, like, really, like, doped up on pain medication when he watched it.
So. Apparently on ketamine.
Look, I don't know. That's what he said. Maybe
what hospital is your brother going to, like, where they give him bath salts?
Hey. I don't know. He even said, like, hey, they said if you take too much of that stuff, you can go into a K-hole. So, beats me. We'll look up the medical uses of ketamine.
Oh, no, it is used mainly for starting and maintaining anesthesia. I have no doubt that this is actually the case. I did not think that's what it was.
Let's do our joys. Chris, what is bringing you joy right now?
What is bringing me joy this week, Matt, is Fallout 4, which is awesome. I was going to wait. I wasn't going to wait, but I said I was going to wait. I said I was going to wait, give it some time, get, you know, the Game of the Year edition next year for like $30. It's going to have all the DLC and whatever. But there was no possibility that I was actually going to do that. Aiden knew that. She bought me Fallout 4 on release day. Since it came out, I've probably put about like 80 hours into it. Or if you are Chad Bowers or any of our editors at Marvel Comics, I probably put like 3 hours into it. But yeah, I really, really enjoy it. I don't want to get too deep into plot stuff because I know that you haven't played it yet. And there's a lot of stuff in that game that is well worth kind of encountering for yourself for the first time. But it fixes the problem that I had with Skyrim and New Vegas, like plot-wise, by taking it back to something that's closer to the plot of Fallout 3. Like, I never felt personally invested in the plot of Skyrim. Like, that, you know, we've talked about that being like my huge problem with it, was that like it doesn't matter. Like, the big overarching Civil War plot, like, just, I didn't care. Like,
right.
As beautiful as that game was, like, I didn't care about anything I was doing. And in New Vegas, like, the main plot felt like just a hassle that I had to go through in order to end the game.
There were a lot of things in New Vegas that were interesting, like the various factions and how you could align with them or not align with them. But in execution, it didn't really feel like you were building up to an ending. You know, it was just like beat the one faction's leader, beat the other faction's leader, or beat them both. And that's all it was.
Yeah, like I really like the idea of Caesar's Legion. Like, I think Caesar's Legion's a really cool idea. And, you know, I think the idea of the NCR kind of trying to rebuild America and expanding eastward is a good idea too. But I had the exact same frustration that I did with Skyrim, which is that, like, there's a point in that game where you can go talk to Caesar, and if you have the option to sneak in a gun and shoot him, and the game just continues proceeding apace. Like, it has no effect on the game. Other than, like, you can't do Caesar's missions anymore, which I wasn't going to do anyway.
Yeah, there's still a final boss that's, like Caesar's main lieutenant or whatever.
Yeah. And Fallout 4, like, in Fallout 3, you're looking for your dad, right? Your dad goes missing, you gotta follow him around. Like, very simple plot, but, you know, one that it's easy to go, like, okay, motivation, got it.
But also, your dad's trying to save the world.
Your dad's trying to save the world, but you're invested in it because of that. Fallout 4, you're looking for your son. So they, like, made it the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's one of those weird things where there's a player desire versus game desire or versus character desire conflict. You know, I talked about that with Red Dead Redemption, where John Marston wants to get that game over with quickly. Like, John Marston should not be doing side quests in Red Dead Redemption, but I want to do side quests. They made a pretty environment for me to, like, go hunt animals in. So whatever, you know, I want to go talk to this weird Yeti. There's a lot of, you know, obviously it's Fallout, so there's a lot of wandering around and exploring. But I feel like the game also does a great job of presenting you with an environment that is so actively hostile against you that if you're going to get anything done, you have to have help. So a lot of what you do in that game is kind of based on, you know, again, there's a lot of faction stuff in that game. I think there's like four major factions involved that you need to, you know, get favors with one way or the other, and those come with responsibilities. And I think that does a really cool thing. It's a different system than Fallout 3 in New Vegas in that there's no skills anymore. Everything is based off perks, to the point where, like, even your core stats, your special stats, are perks. Like, you can, after you set your stats at the beginning of the game, when you level up, one of the things you can do is just put a point in each of the stats. So there's no level cap. I think I'm level like 38, 39 in now, and I'm not even close to like filling out the perk chart, you know? But that changes just enough of how the game works. Like, it changes just enough of how bobbleheads work and skill magazines work and all that stuff. Like, that everything kind of feels fresh and new again. And I've played through Fallout 3 and New Vegas twice each. So it's really fun. I can't wait until you play it, because I know you're eventually going to, and I really want to talk to you about some of the stuff in there. There's one character that I think you will either really like or will make you mad.
Okay. With me, it can be a little hard to judge on that sometimes.
It really can.
I know that Fallout 3 for me turned into, like, such a hard push towards skill magazines. Like, everything I did became about, like, there might be a skill magazine in there. And so I had to go in.
Well, the thing is, now they're permanent.
Yeah.
Like, the skill magazines are all extra perks. So, like, now it's a thing where it's like, okay, I gotta go to every building. Yeah. And also, because it's built around, you know, modding weapons and also building up settlements. Like, you know, Dave Lartigue, our friend, referred to it as a farming simulator, which it kind of is. Like, there's a weird kind of Animal Crossing thing going on there. I played for maybe like 3 hours yesterday, and all I did was build up settlements and make supply lines running through them. And for me, that kind of boring non-game bullshit is really soothing. Like, yes, I'm going to build a house here and put a bed in it, and there's a water pump and some crops. Like, that stuff, I am in my zone. That is all I want out of it. Matt, what is your joy this week?
I'm kind of just bringing it up so we can talk about it. Not that I didn't like it, because I really liked it, but I also feel like everybody who is going to watch it has watched it, has already mainlined all 13 episodes. But I just want us to talk a little bit about Jessica Jones, because it's a really fascinating show to me in some ways. It's very good, but there are little things about it here and there that I just wonder about that choice, you know? Like certain character deaths. There are so many character deaths on that show. And it's, you know, I'm not complaining about that, because it feels like it's actually appropriate to the show, right? Like, those are the stakes of Jessica Jones's life, right? People just die around her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain character deaths where I was like, well, that character didn't have to die, right? I mean, I had the same issue with the Daredevil show. Like, spoiler for the Daredevil show, if anybody hasn't watched it yet.
I haven't watched it yet, but feel free to spoil.
You haven't
it.
Watched Daredevil yet?
I watched, like, one episode, and it was, like, I liked it. It was fine. I really liked Matt and Foggy. But, like, I never, you know. The reason I watched Jessica Jones is because Aiden wanted to watch it, and so we watched the first couple of episodes, and then, like, by the end of, like, episode four, I was like, okay, we gotta watch another one, and then we gotta watch another one. Like, it gets real intense in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, Daredevil kind of works the same way, but well, Daredevil kind of sidetracks in the middle a little bit, and then it gets really intense at the end, but...
I've got all these Power Rangers and Sailor Moons to watch. I can't watch everything.
Spoilers for Daredevil and Jessica Jones. Like, Jessica Jones kills off a cop character who is played by Clark Peters, who is one of my favorite actors, who is this cool older black man. Daredevil kills off Ben Urich.
What?
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why do those characters need to die other than just, like, a shock value thing that happens? Like, I guess the cop dying in Jessica Jones is at least a way to say, oh, Nuke is not actually the good dude you thought he might have been. You know, Officer Simpson.
Okay, so we should have prefaced this one with a spoiler warning.
I did. I said spoilers for Jessica Jones and Daredevil.
You did. You did. But yeah, did y'all know Nuke is in it? Do you know how excited I was?
The casting of Nuke is so perfect.
Amazing, because he, like, no offense to the actor, because he's really good as Nuke, and he's, like, I mean, not Nuke, but Frank Simpson, and he's a very handsome guy, but they have very clearly and very purposefully made him look like a low-rank Chris Evans.
Well, or a low-rank Captain America, because look at his costumes. Look at what he wears.
They made him a failed Captain America.
Yeah. Like, he wears
the best.
He wears a slightly lower quality leather jacket than Steve Rogers does.
It's brilliant. Yeah. Like,
those subtle details are some of my favorite things about the show. And I think the show nails so many of the characters so well. Kristen Ritter is great as Jessica Jones.
Yes.
David Tennant is amazing as the Purple Man.
Really great and terrifying.
Terrifying. And he's not that different from his version of the Doctor, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's not that far removed from the Doctor. He's doing the same accent he does for the Doctor, which is not his regular Scottish accent. He's doing his English accent. And so... he's even kind of the Doctor, but there's this, like, sinister undercurrent to him that is so good. And there are some great scenes where he's, like, trying to be sympathetic, and is convincingly so, right?
Yes.
He's great. Luke Cage is great.
There's a scene, like, the big bar fight scene. He's stabbed in, like, somebody tries to stab him in the neck with a broken bottle, and I have never seen that on television before.
Yeah, there's but the way he handles that bar fight scene, where he's like kind of shooing everybody away with a really light touch.
Yes, because he fights like a guy who can't be hurt.
Yes.
It's like, great.
He's not fighting people to beat them up. He's fighting them to get them away from him, right?
Yeah.
Because they're like flies. They're like they're like nuisances to him.
Yeah, not there was threats. Like someone asked Hugh Jackman like what his favorite Wolverine scene was that he did. And it's that one in he said it was that one in X-Men 2 where they go into Cerebro and he's smoking a cigar and Professor X told him to put the cigar out and he just puts it out in his own hand.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, that's my favorite Wolverine scene because what does it mean that he can hear from everything? Like, what does pain mean to him? It's nothing. It's a momentary inconvenience. And like that, the bar fight, because the bar fight isn't just good for Luke. It's good for Jessica too. Like the way they both fight, like the person who can't be hurt and the person who is, you know, super strong.
Yeah.
Is so much of that. Like, what does this mean for this person? Like, how does this person act in this situation? Like based on what they can do. I should say, like, Kristen Ritter is really great too.
They're both really good. Patsy Walker is really great, and it's weird to me that I didn't realize she was Patsy Walker until like the second or third episode.
Yeah, I kept thinking she was. This is the dumbest nerd. Like, I told this to Aiden, she was like, "You're a horrible nerd." I kept thinking she was Trish Tilby. And kept wondering how they got the rights back from Fox to use Trish Tilby. Because I'm like, Trish Tilby's an X-Men character. How are they going to use Trish Tilby? Like, I knew that Patsy Walker was in it. I had just forgotten.
But, okay, so there are character deaths that I think are maybe a little extraneous. My other thing about the show, and these are minor complaints about a show I mostly liked, but I have to bring them up. The other thing is, like, how much does this show hammer away at superhero names are stupid?
That was something that I couldn't figure out. Because like there's two separate occasions where they called the Hulk the Green Guy.
Yeah.
Which the first time was like fine. But like the second time it's really awkward because I think it's Jessica says something about the Green Guy and the flag waver.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, guys, like, all you have to do is have her say Captain America sarcastically. Like, Captain America is already a silly name.
Somebody brought this up on Twitter, and I think this might be right. It almost feels like some kind of mandated brand split. Where, yes, Jessica Jones takes place in the same universe as the Marvel movies, but they don't want it too closely connected. Because Jessica Jones is a show with some dark, often graphic violence, and very adult themes. And so if you're talking about the Hulk and Captain America, or even S.H.I.E.L.D. on Jessica Jones, then you're tying that franchise very directly to your other franchises. Which, look, Alias the comic had fucking Steve Rogers in it. So it seems a little weird and arbitrary, but it almost makes a level of sense where like,
yeah.
It's like, let's have a disconnect between this thing and these other things. And I kind of like, get that, but there's also just like making fun of Kilgrave's name all the time, even though that's the name the show gave him and making fun of the name Jewel that is suggested to Jessica Jones. It's the Arrow thing, where in the first season of Arrow, it's like, Green Arrow, what a dumb name. And then by this season of Arrow, it's like, well, what else are we going to call him? He's the Green Arrow. Like,
yeah, I could have done with a little less of that. And although I do think Jessica and Night Nurse, like Night Nurse talking about how his name should be Murder, was it Murder Corpse?
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty funny. Murder Carcass. The one thing that didn't work for me was the voiceover narration. Like, I think you could completely cut that out of the show.
It's a noir.
And it would be fine.
It's a noir trope, right?
It's a noir trope, and it's a holdover from the comics. Like, first-person narration works in comics, I think, and you can get away with it more in comics. But, like, I don't feel like it added – and like, it didn't give us any insight into Jessica, really – And I thought it was kind of clunky. Other than that, I really liked the show. And again, spoiler warning, even though we're a couple weeks late getting to it, if you're like dealing it out, Matt, there's a part in this show where Nuke fights Patsy Walker.
Yeah.
And I wanted, like,
it's a great fight scene. It's a really good fight scene.
And I want to have been in the room where they made the decision where somebody was like, well, you know what we should do in like episode 9 is Nuke is taking his reds, and you will not believe how excited I was when he was like, yeah, give me a red. Our boys. Because he does that. Because he did it. Like, somebody said, oh, what if Patsy takes one of Nuke's reds and fights Nuke and knocks him through a wall? Somebody said that, and someone else was like, yes, we should do that. And that was the decision to make.
Yeah. It's great. One last thing. There was one point where I almost gave up on the show and stopped watching it because it got – like I reached this level of being depressed by it, and that is when Hope dies. Literally, Hope dies.
Yes. Like, oh, it's very subtle.
Yeah. That was almost too much for me.
It was like it gets really dark.
Yeah.
And I know that like I am not a I thought Avengers was too dark. Like that's kind of how hardline I am on this. But I think because Alias is a different kind of superhero comic source material and because they're trying to build a cinematic universe where you can do Guardians of the Galaxy and something like this and kind of blend it all together, I gave Jessica Jones a lot more leeway than I would with other superhero stories. And honestly, because it's a show that was, the Netflix version was created by a woman and frequently had women writers and directors.
Yeah.
Like you can get away with a lot more in that. But yeah, like it gets like one of the reasons that I kept watching it because Aiden and I were up to like 4 and I do not usually like mainline those shows. But one of the reasons we did was because like we had to get to a stopping point where it wasn't the worst thing happening, and it took us like 6 hours to do that.
I will say though that the payoff to that, the final showdown with Kilgrave, makes it basically worth it. So all right, we've gone on about comforts and joys for quite a while, so Chris, let's talk about some of the comics that came out this week.
Let's do it.
You knew we had to. We're going to talk about Guardians of Infinity #1. Now,
I have not read this, but I heard it put some hard times out in the world.
The main story of the book is by Dan Ebnett and an artist named Carlo Barberi, who I don't have a ton of familiarity with, but this series, the main series is kind of – the gimmick of it is that it's different Guardians from different time periods, and this is them all kind of coming together. It's a really clever idea and a lot of fun. But there's a backup story in this issue that is fucking Ben Grimm on a wrestling planet being a wrestler, having to wrestle for a device that can get him and Rocket Raccoon off the planet. It starts with a flashback where Ben Grimm is delivering a Dusty Rhodes-style promo. Then it flashes forward, and this story, by the way, I should note, is by Jason Latour, who has been on the show, I consider to be a friend of the show, great artist and writer in his own right, art by Jim Cheung, so it looks amazing. It flashes forward to the Thing and Rocket Raccoon being on this planet that the entire culture of the planet has been influenced by Earth wrestling. They love it. They actually watched Ben Grimm in his old wrestling days and were inspired by him. So they're forcing him to be a wrestler to get what he needs to get off the planet. But they're kind of just playing him, right? Like they're making him wrestle, and they just want to see him wrestle and wrestle and wrestle. And they really want to see him turn really heel so they have somebody to boo. And there's a point where Ben Grimm, who is wrestling under the name The Monster, gives in and is like, you want a heel? I'll give you a heel. And he rips off his shirt and he says, you want to be the man? You got to beat the monster. And everybody goes after him and like starts fighting him. And there's this, just this one moment where he's overwhelmed. And then he ends up getting kind of saved from that, but it is such a great story. And I'm not taking anything away from the main Guardians of Infinity story, which is really fun in its own right and has a great cliffhanger. But good Lord, this Ben Grimm wrestling story is like comic story of the year.
Oh, I gotta read that one.
You gotta read it. It is so good. And who would not think that a Ben Grimm as a wrestler story would be one of our favorite stories, right? Rocket Ajax favorite.
Yeah, obviously.
All right, up next we're going to talk about Batman and Robin Eternal number 9.
Yeah, I don't know how it happened, but Batman and Robin Eternal has turned into the 90s Batman comic that I want so badly. It's so great. I love it. I love what's going on. I love how it's developing. The plot with Mother has really picked up, and it has become a thing where, you know, Mother is basically like providing rich men with like their ideal wives. And so obviously, you know, Batman is using Bruce Wayne to kind of infiltrate this, figure it out, but Mother figures out who he is. And so instead of offering, you know, Bruce Wayne, rich billionaire, a custom-made perfect wife, what she's offering him is a custom-made perfect Robin in the flashback story, which is a great idea because it plays on like a lot, like, first of all, plays on a lot of subtext, which is fine, but it also plays on this idea that, like, you know, the idea that Dick was worried that he wasn't good enough, and now Bruce is going to be worried that, you know, maybe not worried that he's not good enough, but worried that, you know, he's putting this, you know, a real person in the line of fire when he could just have this, you know, custom built person to be Robin. I think that's an interesting setup. That's all. That's the flashback story. That's kind of the Mother stuff that's going on. The main thing that happens in this issue is that Red Robin and Jason Todd, Red Robin and Red Hood, go to Santa Prisca, where the Order of St. Dumas has set up a new cathedral on the site of the prison where Bane was born. And the Order of St. Dumas is using weird magic technology to perform actual miracles. And they have they're slowly taking over Santa Prisca. There's a part where they're getting ready to lay siege to this big, you know, crystal cathedral. And Jason Todd's like, I just know that they're men, and men can be killed. And all of a sudden, Bane jumps out of the jungle and punches him in the face and goes, not all men. This, like, Batman and Robin Eternal is the stuff. It is a hoot.
Yeah, I am a little behind on it, and I need to catch up, but that sounds delightful.
Yeah, like I've said before, like, it's, you know, I'm kind of forcing myself to get in the habit of reading it every week just because it's something I can go and read every week, and then I'll at least have one comic to talk about on the show. But it is so rewarding and so goofy and so, like, 90s-ass Batman. Like, look, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I'm going to. The last page is Azrael showing up. And yeah. Not like Michael Lane Azrael, like flaming sword, red costume, John Paul Valley ass Azrael. Like, it is delightful.
Yeah, that sounds great. The last comic that we're going to talk about is Totally Awesome Hulk number 1. Now, let me preface this by saying I know that there are people who are not reading this book because Frank Cho is the artist. I didn't actually realize that he did the interior art until I cracked it open. But if that is what is keeping you from reading the book because of some inflammatory and quite honestly like provocateur style stuff that he's done in sketch covers, that is completely understandable. But it is a shame that people are not able to, for those reasons, to check out the book, because the story is really fun. Greg Pak is doing a great job with the character of Amadeus Cho, who, you know, he sort of If he didn't co-create Amadeus Cho, which I think he did, right, Chris?
He did. It was him and Takeshi Miyazawa in okay. Amazing Fantasy.
Okay. So he has such a great handle on that character, right? And we get a little bit of origin stuff for him in this issue. We get a great view of him as a character. We get some great stuff with him and his sister. We get a little bit of an opening thing where he is on the beach to help out some people who were in danger, being attacked by kind of a turtle creature. And then he starts to get into kind of the main plot stuff after that. The effects of gamma radiation on Amadeus Cho are really interesting because he's 19 years old. So, you know, Chris, the effects of gamma radiation on Bruce Banner are to really amplify his anger, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is something in a 19-year-old that might be amplified?
Oh, no.
Amadeus has turned into a little bit of a horn dog because of the gamma stuff. And it sounds, look, that could be handled really badly. Pac makes it funny and not gross. In much the same way, you remember, the story from Incredible Hercules with the love goddess stuff and how that was just kind of fun. That's how it's handled here too. While it sounds like it could be creepy and weird, it is not. It is actually fun. So if you were not 100% put off by the Frank Cho stuff, which, look, it's understandable if you are, it is a fun book and a fun read if you feel like picking it up. All right, Chris, that's it for our comics reviews. Let's get into our interview segment with our old pal, Tom Fowler.
For the program this week, we are very excited to welcome back a longtime friend of the show, a friend who has been on this show since I think you made your first appearance back in the huge year. The original, the prototype version of War Rocket Ajax.
Cast your memories back in time.
You will know him as one of the best artists going in comics, and just the one of the best around, one of the tallest Canadians.
Yeah.
His current project is a Kickstarter for D&D, the tabletop fantasy art of Tom Fowler. Tom Fowler, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Christopher and Matthew.
Now,
I come on the show in character.
Oh, is this your character? Like, did we play like a half giant or something?
No, I'm making this up as I go along. No, I now play. I am now a gnome barbarian with a donkey head named Plick.
That sounds about right.
Who's essentially very much the same as the giant. I actually just I built one out of the carcass of the other. He feels a lot more fun to play. Plus, he can scuttle all over the place.
Which Tom, is cool.
I've got like plus 20 to scuttle.
Tom, the voice you were just doing, is like every TV dungeon master voice. Are you familiar with a British TV show called
and
Nightmare?
It slays the ladies.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of Nightmare spelled with a K? Which was a show in the UK in the 80s where they would send kids on a green screen Dungeons and Dragons like adventure. And there was like a dungeon master guy that would tell them what to do. But he would only kind of just say like, "Your friend's life force is fading." And they would show a graphic of a kid with the skin peeling off his face.
Oh my God.
Your childhood friend will die if you don't get me a soda.
I feel like that would be the perfect like origin story for Tom Fowler. Like if you had seen that and you were like, "Oh, well this is what I should draw like."
I was on the very last episode. Nobody ever told me it was ending. So I just kept hitting the same button and it'd be like,
Now, Tom, you've been on the show before, and you've talked about your Dungeons and Dragons and doodles that you've done. So before we get into that, there's a line of questioning I want to bring up. How tall are you?
Why? I'm 6'4", 6'5", somewhere in there.
Why? What?
Okay. It's interesting to anyone?
Like, yes. Here's why it's interesting. Right. Because okay. here's the three Canadian comic book creators that I know personally. It's you, 6'4", 6'5". It's Ryan North, like 6'5", 6'6", maybe. Okay. And then it's Chip Zdarsky, who is like shorter than me. Why did you steal his height? What magic did you do?
Well, it was a plus three in heightening spell. I cast on Chip when I first met him, when he was named Steve, and that was all. I mean, he got all the success, right? So he's fine. He's doing okay. He's fine. He out of that. I mean, he got his Garfield costume. Which, you know, he goes to all the schools, hangs out up front in his Garfield costume, meets a lot of people that way. He's doing great, you know, hanging out in front of schools, dressed like Garfield. He's never washed it, by the way, which is, people should know, especially in front of those schools.
That's...
Got a van.
I feel like if you were talking about anyone else... Garfield
on the side. What? Which? What?
I feel like if you were talking about anyone else, we would have to cut this all. But it's like Chip's not gonna sue for us building the legend.
Oh, of Chip and his Garfield van.
Of Chip and his Garfield van.
The crazy thing about
he Chip... had a show. We have a network here in Ontario called TV Ontario, which is like a little. It's like the public, not public access, but publicly funded, like PBS style thing for Ontario, and Chip. Did for a long time have his own TV show called Chip's Wonderful Garfield Van with Magic, and it got shut down real quick. Like the Jim Davis people came in and got real angry, but it was, you know, for eight episodes there, it was pretty great.
Canadian TV, eight episodes is a good run, I think, generally. Isn't that right?
No. Canadian TV outlives its welcome. If 12 people watch a show in Canada, it is like it's an insane success, and it will go on for at least 15 years.
Yeah, y'all got that Canadian TV going.
Yeah. Well, and you know, a bunch of networks desperately trying to prove their value to themselves. I don't know. To the audience. Sure. I mean, it's how you get to what, like 27 seasons of the Beachcombers and 38 seasons of The Littlest Hobo and however many other things. I think Corner Gas was on for at least 87 years.
I remember when Corner Gas started airing here at like 3 o'clock in the morning on like the local CW affiliate, and I gave it an honest shot. I gave it a try.
Corner Gas was great. It just kept being the same thing forever, and it was like, all right, I thought this is
No,
and then after a while, you just got tired of it. You know?
Now, Tom, you also mentioned The Littlest Hobo just now,
yeah,
and that is something that several friends of mine. Obsessed is too strong a word, but interested is not strong enough to describe their reactions to The Littlest Hobo.
It's a hard watch. It's one of those things that it did not age well at all. But it was ubiquitous. Like when you were growing up, it was on all the damn time. It was like our Incredible Hulk. It was the Canadian version of the Incredible Hulk. It was literally the exact same show as The Incredible Hulk. It was like a dog that would be adopted by some kid that named it Snowplow for that week, and it helped it, I don't know, get out of a hole in the ground or something. They were making a fence and he got his foot caught and, oh, the hero. It's at least that interesting. And
for the benefit of our non-Canadian listeners, could you describe the overarching plot of The Littlest Hobo?
I just did.
That was a specific example.
Hulk. It was okay. Picture the Incredible Hulk, the old 1970s, 1980s Incredible Hulk TV show, starring Mr. William Bixby. Only Mr. William Bixby is in fact a German Shepherd, without any superpowers other than being a bit more intelligent than other German Shepherds. Because a German Shepherd is smaller than the average hobo, because lamb, he's the littlest hobo, because hobos are ranked by volume. So this dog, played not by, I don't want to confuse your listeners, the dog was not played by Sir William Bixby, it was played by a German Shepherd named Smokey or Rango or Richard, any of those. It would go from town to town. And it would get adopted by some family, and there'd be some unscrupulous landlord or something. So there'd be some, like, mustache. It was, you know, 1970s Canadian TV, so everyone had a mustache. So you had to, you know, really make sure who had the twirliest ones, because that would be your villain. It would just help the family, and then there'd be a teary scene, and they'd be like, well, why can't you stay? Anonymous dog that we let into our house, stray dog who probably is swimming with fleas and disease. Why won't you stay with us, stray dog? And then it would to quiet piano music, it would go back on the highway, just like the Hulk.
Was there really piano music?
I think so. No, it had that same like synthesizer music. Like it would just play the. It would play like a section of the main theme, which can be Googled very easily and will get stuck in your head for the rest of your life.
Oh, we're going to put that in the show notes. Why didn't any of these families figure out that you could close the door and keep a dog in the house? Or buy a leash?
It was slightly smarter than the average German Shepherd, which made it vastly more intelligent than the average Canadian TV family. So it was wily, and it would tug on your little heartstrings, it'd get in through the kids, or it would, you know, help an old lady across the street whatever dogs do to help old ladies cross the street. And then they'd be like, oh, well, I'm going to take you home and feed you, stray dog. So, yeah, it was a classic. I swear to God they went through at least five of those dogs. It was on the air. So, but it cost nothing to make. And if you watch it on if you watch it on YouTube, you will see all I made to screen. It is hard to go. We tried when we were in our 20s, ironic little dickbags and whatever, like we found like a videotape of it at some flea market and we're like, yay! Cause this is pre-internet cause I'm old. And we're like, let's watch this ironically. And we made it like an episode and a half in, and it was just like having a truck on your chest. It was just like, oh God, what am I watching? Why are we doing this? Irony isn't worth it. Let's grow up. And then I start working in comics.
The thing that I love about The Littlest Hobo is that it's a thing that, like, you mention it to Canadians, and they're like, yeah, yeah, Littlest Hobo, you know, a little dog runs around, gets in adventures, it ran for a million years.
People are proud of it here. Like, yeah. It's just so, I mean, it's just because we all, nobody's gone back and watched it, right? So, but everybody here is like, oh, that was our show, and it was a big deal, and it was a huge deal, and it was a blah blah blah. And so, you know, I remember watching the – there's the – are you familiar with Spaced?
The, yes. Yes.
The progenitor to all the aggravated movies. There is actually in the second season of Space, actually I think toward the end of the first season of Space too, there's a bunch of Littlest Hobo stuff, like with Colin the Dog. There is a musical sting from it. There is a plot from the, there's a slightly a bit of a plot. And in the commentary tracks, because there's both like the original British commentary track and the new American one. When he's explaining it, when they're talking about it, in both, I mean, he refers to it thinking that it was an Australian show. And I remember getting angry, going like, those fucking criminals, they got their own shit. About surfers and stuff. Give us a dog. You know, kind of thing. So it was, yeah, it fills you with, I think, some weird nationalistic enthusiasm that could be better spent on almost anything.
Do you think?
Almost anything.
Do you feel the same way, Tom, about the Red Green Show and its 4,000 episodes?
Not at all. not in any way, shape, or form. I was. I think I was too old for Red Green when it came out, and I remember seeing it and going, "Oh yeah, that's a thing." I do, however, remember Steve Smith, who is Red Green, had a previous sketch comedy show with his wife. I think it was called like Smith and Smith Comedy Machine or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. It had exactly one good reoccurring sketch, which was based on a children's show again here in Canada called The Polka Dot Door. I remember nothing at all about it except thinking that when I was eight, that it was the funniest goddamn thing in the world. And they would finish every show, because it was like a Canadian variety show. They would finish every show by singing the same damn song, which now that I think of it was like a trope in Canadian sketch comedy for a while. Cause Wayne Schuster used to do it. Somebody else used to do it as well. And I was just like, oh, God in heaven. And it was always the same damn song, because they were like – Wayne Schuster did it because they were like old school comedians and you put on a vaudeville show and blah, blah, blah. I don't know why these two ever did it. And I still know every single word in that song. And it's taking up some part of my brain that could be curing cancer and isn't. And so I'm sorry. I'm sorry I haven't been cured.
I just
apologize.
They used to show Red Green on PBS stations here. Maybe they still do.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah.
The way that it always, like, the one joke of Red Green, at least to my American brain, has always been Canadians have rednecks too. And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about it. But I mean, then you got like Trailer Park Boys, which actually did that well, you know, because that's basically the plot. That's what Trailer Park Boys is all about, right? But yeah, I don't Red. Red Green was one of those. It also had like a couple people on Red Green from another sketch comedy thing that I loved when I was a kid called The Frantics. They had a show called Four on the Floor. And that was another one that I was like, oh, I can't revisit this, because I tried watching it again when I was in college. And I was like, I thought this was great when I was 12. But not so much anymore. But one of the main guys from that went on to be in Red Green is a guy named Rick Green, who was the host of one of my very favorite shows that really genuinely inspired like an entire generation of Canadian cartoonists, at least from this part of the country, called Prisoners of Gravity, which was like it was like pre-internet podcasting. It was basically like the plot of it, such as it was a guy gets Rick gets very pissed off about the state of the world. And this is all told through like a montage of Ty Templeton drawings. Gets really pissed off at the state of the world and flies into space. He rigs up his car and so that he can fly into space, but then he hits a satellite where he gets – where he's stuck, but he – get this – gets 140 channels. I know, it's the future. What they wound up doing, though, is they would have these marathon interviews with every comics, science fiction, fantasy author or luminary that you can think of that was still alive in, you know, the late 80s to early 90s, which was everyone. And they would have these really great long interviews with them, and then they chop them up to fit that segment of the interview in with whatever the theme of the show was that week. And there's a ton of it there's a ton of it online on YouTube and stuff, and it's well worth it. The first season is not great because they were still trying to figure out their format, but everything beyond that was just incredible. And so we were getting exposed to all this stuff that we never would have been exposed to in any other circumstance.
If I can pull things back just a little bit, the thing
yes,
that
I apologize for being sincere, Chris.
Look, it makes me uncomfortable. I don't like it. I don't appreciate sincerity.
I have a sincerity doll I can send you. Show me where I sincered you.
The rough jungles, Fowler. But the reason I bring it up is because everyone in Canada knows The Littlest Hobo. Everyone in America thinks it's something the person they're talking to is making up on the spot.
No. I wish there were. I could hit you with a bunch of other Canadian shows that I literally I've had people kind of saying like you're fucking with me, right?
Well, you talk about things like, you know, like Red Green obviously made it down here. I've seen that. Trailer Park Boys has made it down here. Degrassi, Kids in the Hall, like those are things that we all, you know, got down here. But then like The Littlest Hobo is like, wait, the hobo is a dog? Like, yeah. Is this animated? No, it's live action. No,
it's live action.
Yeah, it's like it. I'm still not entirely convinced that it's not something every Canadian I know is making up.
There was a big period. Like we also had like a thing called Hammy Hamster.
No, that's obviously fake. That's obviously
Which was I was convinced it was Canadian. I think it became Canadian, but I was. I did a little bit of research and discovered that it started in England, but it was literally, yeah, it was like, it was called like Tales of the Riverbank. And it was like a bunch, it was like a hamster named Hammy. There was a guinea pig named GP. There were mice, there were rats, there were other things. They all lived on this like fake riverbank set. And it was actual rodents running around, and they would get like shots of them where they would stand still and they'd feed them peanut butter so their little mouths would move. And they would tell these stories. So like they basically made stuff out of junk. So like Hammy Hamster had a hovercraft that was made out of a vacuum cleaner. That was basically just the end of a vacuum cleaner that they would hover around on. They had a diving bell that they would go down in. They would put this poor goddamn guinea pig in a plane. And to this day, I still can't quite recall if, because there were a bunch of shots, there'd be like shots, close-ups of him when he was like, and he's, when he's like, I'm saving the day, you know, kind of thing, whatever he was doing in his airplane, where it would be like a close up shot where obviously they're not flying the plane, and he's like half out of the plane because, like, I don't know if you know this about guinea pigs, but they are not good flyers, and they don't want to stay in the cockpit of like a circa World War I biplane. But there would be all these shots of just like a long shot of somebody out in a field with like an RC plane, which I still to this day cannot recall whether or not there actually was a guinea pig in the air in that plane. There were certainly a bunch of shots of it coming in for a landing, and there was a guinea pig in it. A lot of non-American places had shows like that. Like, Australia used to have a show called Skippy the Kangaroo.
There's literally no way you are not making up this show about the hamster that flies around in a hovercraft.
I'm not making any of it up. I'm sure it's all online. It was bizarre. Like, I can't remember any of the specific plots, but I know just based on, hey, we need to go down to the bottom of the river. Let's get in this. And they would literally, it was like a glass bell that they put these animals inside and submerged it in water. And, and there was some other show that was like, it was some fish show, which was literally just, they had a lot of like marine footage and they just put voices over it and would tell these stories, but they were just like, you know, it was like, I think it started a crab. I'm not 100% sure, but they just had like all this footage of like crabs and fish and dogfish and whatever interacting or not interacting. They would be like completely different. They would probably be shot from completely different parts of the ocean. But they'd have one. It was like, I remember he had a girlfriend that was a crab as well. It's just like, it was one of those things where it was like, well, we've got this footage. Might as well put some voices over it and try and sell it to kids, you know?
Well,
because
Tom,
they had filled time.
Tom, while we're talking about the fantastical creatures of the sea and land, who can speak?
Oh, I sense a segue.
That's right.
Go on, Matthew.
Let's talk about D&D.
You're doing great. Okay.
Let's talk about your book that is on Kickstarter right now, and that is all your...
Oh, you surprised me with that.
Your tabletop... gaming art. All this, we've talked about the Tumblr that you did.
Yes.
That has some of that art on it. But give me the pitch for the book.
The book is essentially, a rescanned and like high definition or high resolution version of the first year or so of the blog. So what we've done is I've rescanned everything to make sure that it looks as much like it does on the page as possible, we're just republishing it on paper in a handsome little hardcover with all the, you know, pithy little comments underneath, and the book itself will look like a field journal, basically. But that was, I mean, it's a very simple thing. I wanted, you know, I had people forever asking me like when I was going to publish these in a book, and, you know, I always wanted to have that like physical object to, you know, like to, just to make it feel a little bit more real and be able to have like this thing that I could show people and give them and sell them. But that's, you know, ultimately that's what it is. It's basically, you know, the whole thing started. I'm sure I've told this story on here before, but the whole thing, like the whole D&D started with me getting to a point in my career where I really did not like drawing anymore, and I got very, very sad. Started as a way to deal with depression, just get the hell out of the house. I started going and playing D&D with friends, and gradually started drawing while I was doing it, and started enjoying drawing more and more and more. To the point where I started bringing old sketchbooks and filling those up. And because I was so excited about actually enjoying what I was, you know, actually enjoying the act of drawing again, I got really excited. And I was like, I share this with people. And I started with the blog. There was a certain point at which I really did start to think like, I would love to see these on paper. I would like this. I would love to see these be a thing that people can flip through. Because I love sketchbooks and I love art books and I love like that kind of thing. And it felt right. Like it felt like a nice, it's so, you know, the act of playing and the act of drawing and, you know, writing stuff down is so tactile that it just, it felt right to kind of put it in a book and try and put that book in people's hands.
You know that I am a big fan of your D&D drawings. Like, you've talked about them on the show. We've talked about them in person. I follow the Tumblr, which is
Growing Giants. We've talked about all sorts of things.
We have. We've talked about all the penises.
All we call dongs here in Canada.
All the dongs in your D&D artwork. And if people want to check that out, if they want to get a sample before they hit up the Kickstarter, which everyone should do, is it still TomFowlerDDD .tumblr.com?
It absolutely is, yeah. And it will be that forever, luckily. We just switched internet providers a little while ago, and I got stuck in that horrible cycle of I lost my old email address and I couldn't remember my password. If you need a new email address, or rather, if you need to change your password, they need to send it to your email address. But if you don't have that old email address, then screw you. So I was very close to just shutting it down and starting a new one called AD&D&D.
Well, I am glad that you did not have to do that.
No, it's just too clever, and it would make me feel icky.
Well, because there's so much great stuff on there. Because I think my favorite thing about it is that each picture has the little captions that I'm sure make a lot of sense to you.
Well, it's my version of a web strip. I mean, it's a, half of the time they actually have to do what's in the picture. Half the time they have to do with what's in the picture in a much more oblique way. there's very much a line of ennui that goes through many of the creatures that I draw that are often just kind of looking off in the distance and thinking about their relationships, which I think is the most hysterical thing in the world. So I love the idea that it's some kind of mutant badger thinking about what Cynthia said the night before. It just tickles me. And then beyond that, yeah, it literally is. It's as close as I'm ever going to get to doing a web strip. Because there's zero pressure involved. And, if it doesn't come across as funny, I can always say, well, that one's clever.
it plays like a web comic too, but in this weird way that I don't think you usually see from a lot of things, because, you know, you're playing a campaign, and campaigns are ongoing narratives. And so you're drawing scenes from an ongoing narrative that four people have experienced.
Yeah. The thing is, like, I'm not actually drawing the campaign. There, every so often I'll draw one of my characters, and I will draw something that maybe has something to do with what we're doing on the table. But 9 times out of 10, it's literally just me moving the pencil around. Like, if you see a little dude with a donkey head in there, yeah, that's based on something. It's often literally just like, I'm going to draw a fish monster today. And he's going to be thinking about, you know, whether or not he paid his mortgage on time. Or whatever, you know, something funny. Imagine I said something funny just there. See, that one was clever.
See, imagination. Yeah. Let the imagination take over. Yeah, and add the laughs.
Yeah. There is a full laugh track, right? Still?
Yeah, I think we've got one.
Oh yeah.
Did you just take that with them, or what's the deal with it? Yeah.
We use the laugh track straight from old episodes of SCTV.
Sweet.
It's our tribute to John Candy.
Yeah. We have talked so much about Canadian TV and a little bit about D&D, but now I think it is time for us to pivot to talking to our listeners who have sent us questions on Twitter.
That's right, Matt. We like to do that each week here on the show. And if people want to get in on that, if people want to ask some questions to the guests that we have here on War Rocket Ajax, how can they go about that?
Well, this is only under the assumption that whoever is listening is a wily and clever German shepherd who has just an inclination to hit the road. Go from town to town, go into people's houses, doing something good for them, have them take you in, feed you, then get into some hijinks and trouble. Once those hijinks and trouble are over, leave, go to the next town. Now, if you're a person,
go to a library, check out some pornography, then look on your Twitter.
Yeah, if you're a person.
That's what hobos do, right? Isn't that what hobos do?
They may just look at pornography at the library. That's true. So
I didn't realize you guys were talking about the internet, and I was like, do Canadian libraries have pornography?
Like, there's a whole shelf of old swanks in the Canadian libraries. Go to twitter.com, sign up for an account, follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, the ISB, that's Chris, and wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 6:30 Pacific, and one of us will put out the call for questions for our guest, very much like the questions you're about to hear for Tom Fowler. The first question we have is from Euclid on Twitter. What is the most ridiculously broken Dungeons & Dragons player character you've ever encountered, Tom Fowler?
Meaning non-player character or one of the characters that I've had to play?
I literally only have the information in the tweet in front of me, but let's.
I'm asking you to interpret it, Matthew.
let's parse it. Let's parse it, okay, Tom?
I don't know. This isn't going to be terribly funny. When I first started playing, my character was a Yeti named Wookwit Yan. That's another Canadian sting that nobody's going to get. I remember I really enjoyed him. When it came time to leveling him up and giving him powers and stuff like that, I didn't actually read any of the what the powers were. I would just go by the names of the powers and what sounded the most kung fu, and that seemed to work fine for me until we went off and we played something else for a bit. We played a different campaign for a bit, and then we came back to it, and I had a better idea of how to play by the stage. So when I came back to the character, I was like, wow, this guy sucks. What was I thinking? I can't do anything. I'm just standing and blowing on people. I can't. So there was that. I mean, but that's the only thing I can think of. I honestly, my history with the game is unfortunately not as complete as I wish it were, because between the ages of 13 and 33, I played nothing. nothing at all. So it was literally just in those moments when my wife was like, you know what? I don't want you in the house on Thursday nights, so go play D&D. That was the entry for me into all of this. So I was lost for a very long time. And I think most of the characters I was playing were very broken. When we were playtesting 5th edition, too, I literally had one of my characters have a psychotic break so I could completely redo the character as something entirely different. And his name, just because this is actually funny, it was Nickbeard Darkwinkle.
I like that. I like that a lot. The next question is from Barely Sushi on Twitter. As an experienced player, despite having a fallow period, do you have any advice for convincing this person's DM to let them play as an elf that's two dwarves in a trench coat?
I would say just do it. roll up the character, roll up the character with the trench coat, and just, it's your actor's secret. I've made a habit, because I get bored easily, so I've made a habit on literally every character I've created to go so outside the rule base that we basically just kind of say, okay, maybe this. I see no reason why you couldn't be able to do that. I would say build it as the elf, but keep a couple of those dwarfy powers. As long as you're committed to the two of them always being in that trench coat together at all times. They are magically inseparable. They must always be inside that trench coat. I don't see any reason why you couldn't roll that character up. In fact, I want to see that character. That might actually show up D&D next week. That's awesome.
Better to ask forgiveness than permission, right? Okay.
I would say roll up that character as the elf, and then just let a few things slip every now and again. There's a second voice coming from down below. There's a suspicious say, hey, why don't you take off that coat? Stay a while. No. Keep that going.
I gotta say, if your DM won't let you play as two dwarves in a trench coat pretending to be an elf, get a new DM.
I know, that would be the next thing I was gonna say.
Tales to Enrage on Twitter wants to know, how many owl bears have you drawn, and is it enough?
I don't believe I've ever drawn an owl bear, and that's probably not enough for Tales to Enrage.
Is it enough for you, though?
I could draw a bear that looks like an owl. I mean, part of the thing is, like, I don't really draw, like... I mean, when I draw, quote unquote, an orc, it's an orc as I see it. It's not, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not like opening up the monster manual. I'm not delving through the fiend folio. Every time I'm drawing these things, I just like, I literally move a pencil around. When, you know, my sense of pattern recognition, kicks in, I chase down whatever that is. So whether that be a thing or another thing. I'm very tired. Did I mention that before the interview? I'm very tired.
So it's not the soundtrack to the movie. It's the music inspired by the movie, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The next question is from Mike Sterling, our friend. Is the gelatinous cube the best?
No.
Well, he had a note here that answers other than yes are incorrect. Oh. So,
oh, is it? Well, see, thing is, just tonight we actually played a version. We fought a version of that, which was like the Cronenberg version of a gelatinous cube, and I'd have to say that it was better.
Okay,
it was in the ass,
but it was still a gelatinous cube, Tom.
Yeah, we were literally right now. We were inside like some kind of weird like Cronenberg thing. Like, there's like the walls are all skin with the orifices and all sorts of stuff like that. And I have to stress here, I'm not the DM. But yeah, it's just all sorts of, and we got hit up by this dude. I mean, I literally came fresh from a game tonight. We got hit up by this big disgusting gooey mass of awful. That was, for all intents and purposes, a gelatinous cube. And one of us got sucked in, and the rest of us debated how to get him out. And I still think I could have just stabbed him with a javelin and just kept pushing. And everybody was like, that's not right. And, you know, they got all antsy about it. I mean, that's how I'd save you guys.
I could only imagine that's how you would do it. The next question comes from our pal Franz Ferdinand II, Ben Gully, who wants to know, what is everyone's preferred class?
I like to play barbarians. I don't pay a lot of attention. So I like to play characters who don't pay a lot of attention. I like to run around doing whatever the hell I want. So having a little dude that's quote-unquote chaotic neutral, running around killing and eating whoever he wants, scuttling around walls and whatever. Just it's just for, you know, for my mental state, it does wonders. So that's where I'm at.
Chris, what about your preferred class?
I prefer simplicity over everything else. So I tend to play fighters in mind, because like fighters are very easy and very customizable. Like, you can be an archery swashbucklery type. You can be like a big heavy guy with a big heavy weapon.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing with barbarians. It's like playing a fighter, but it's fun. You know, like, you don't have, because I mean, when we play fourth edition, so it's like a fighter is a very specific thing. So you basically just take a lot of damage. Like, that's your role, and that's not as fun for me. Like, I'm quite happy to jump into shit and get stabbed and get, you know, completely messed up with every fight. But at the same time, I want to do to them what they're doing to me.
Well, see, I stick with Pathfinder.
Okay, fair enough.
So there's a lot more like options for what falls under fighter, but you know, generally I like to have, here are the three attacks that I can choose one of these to do every round. Like, I do not like playing wizards, sorcerers more so, because you don't have to have the spell book. You just have your stuff that you can do. But as soon as you have to start keeping like another piece of paper, then I'm out. I'm done. I'm not playing casters. So, also rogues. I like rogues a lot too.
Yeah, in video games, I tend to go for magic users.
Nobody asks about video games, Matthew.
Well, I'm having to go on what I know, and I don't play a lot of tabletop games. And in those kinds of things, I go for magic stuff because I can keep a distance and use projectiles. But in tabletop stuff, it just means, like, you know, having another piece of paper. So I think I would probably go for thief or rogue, in that kind of thing, too, because I like that lateral thinking. Charlotte of Oz on Twitter has our last question.
Oh, boy.
What friendship ruining rules argument or addition war readily springs to mind when you think about tabletop? Like, what do you think of as like the top argument about either rules or additions that you have gotten into or that you are most aware of?
Well, I mean, the last time can go back to the last time I was on the show when I had the perfectly logical plan after we killed a giant to empty of its contents,
yes.
Wait inside for the other giants to come along, say, oh my God, Og is dead, and then take us to their king to say, these little guys killed Og. What are we going to do? At which point we would jump out of the giant and we would kill everybody. Totally logical. It's like mathematics. It was perfect. It was bulletproof. It was absolutely genius. Everybody else seemed to think that was a bad idea, and words were spoken, angry words, unfair words, and then I came to understand later on that they thought that we were going to puppet the giant in some way, which is ludicrous, and I got even angrier. That's pretty much still that one. If you're going to kill a giant, you climb inside and you wait till it takes you to its king. Logical.
Well, the fact that you're holding on to that months later is indicative of how important it is to you.
I have made friends because of Dungeons & Dragons. I have lost friends because of Dungeons & Dragons.
Well, the thing is, too, is like the hollowing out of a giant solution is kind of indicative of the way I play D&D. The group I'm with is very kind of rules based, and they're very kind of it's more of a tabletop strategy thing. So, you know, as role playing goes, there's not a lot, like, people are making decisions inside their characters, but they're not, you know, there's a lot of table talk of like, okay, you do this, then I'll do this, and then, you know, whatever. And I like every so often just to screw everything up for everybody, because I want everybody, including the DM, to actually have to like break out of that. You know what I mean? Like, it gets too staid after a while. So I like to mix things up a little bit. So I kick down a lot of doors. And in fact, I'm gonna plug my I don't know, have we talked about my Kickstarter yet? There's a level on the Kickstarter called the Agent of Chaos level, where I will Skype into your game, and I will destroy your universe, because that's fun.
I don't know that it's entirely an enticement, Tom, but it does sound like it would be fun, and that's gonna wrap it up. Go ahead. Get mad.
Exciting.
Exciting, yes.
I'm just saying.
All right. Before we wrap up, Tom, you've mentioned the Kickstarter. We're going to link the Kickstarter in the show notes. But
hooray!
Where else can
people... And I was promised a bump.
Okay.
I was promised a bump.
So, listeners, you got to do
it. Coming out of your paycheck.
Our reputation is on the line here. We got to give them the Ajax bump. But Tom, where can people find you otherwise on the internet?
Otherwise, they can find me on the Twitters at Tom Fowler Bug, or they can find me at my other Tumblr, which is tomfowlerstuff.tumblr.com. I also have a blog that I never update, so there's not much point. But that's about it for me. That's just me. And there will, unfortunately, we weren't able to talk about tonight, but there will be an announcement within the next month of a big new project that I'm working on that I'm very excited about. So keep your ears to the ground, kids, people, folks.
Well, that is very exciting.
And give me your money.
The Kickstarter for D&D is going to run, I believe, through the end of this week. You've got a couple of days left if you're listening to this show when it goes up. So it's very easy to find. If you type in D&D into Google, the first thing that comes up is Tom's blog, and the second thing is that Kickstarter. So we will have a link to it on warrockajax.com, and everyone should get in on this. It's fantastic art. Tom, you're one of my favorites. You're a great guy. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Thanks once again to Tom Fowler. Seriously, go check out that Kickstarter and throw a couple bucks his way so we can all get that book. It's going to be really awesome.
And now, Chris, it is time for us to take a question from one of our listeners on Tumblr. This one is actually from an anonymous listener, but they're looking for some suggestions, okay? They say they were listening to an ESE special when we ranked Dark Knight, Dark City.
That's a good
and,
one.
And I brought up a point that this person has recently realized as well, that the Riddler, this person's favorite Batman villain, has a dearth of great stories. They've read and really enjoyed Zero Year, Dark Knight, Dark City, Batman Adventures number 10, The Riddle Factory by Matt Wagner and Dave Taylor, and the Paul Dini Detective Comics run. They were wondering if we had any suggestions for other good Riddler stories.
Nope. That's all of them.
That's pretty much it. I mean, aside from like animated series episodes...
No, like my favorite Riddler story is from Batman Adventures number 10.
Yeah.
Which it's actually called The Last Riddler Story. So very easy to remember. That's my all-time favorite Riddler story. It's kind of my all-time favorite Riddler Batman interaction. But honestly, other than that, all of my go-to recommendations would be the ones that you mentioned. So.
Yeah, they even mentioned Batman Adventures number 10.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I hate to say it, but I don't know if there's anywhere else for you to go much. The problem with the Riddler is that Riddler stories have to be clever. And I know if I was presented with, hey, write Batman, and the first story you write has to be a Riddler story, I would agonize over it. It would be so hard to write because you'd have to write a story where the two smartest people at the very least in a city have a battle of wits, you know?
Yeah. It's like I wrote a short post at Comics Alliance about a Riddler statue that's coming out, like a Riddler maquette. And I realized I was like, oh, it would be fun if the headline was a riddle. And the lead was the answer, and so I wrote when is this toy, you know, when is this statue like a tall ship under construction, when it's up for pre-sale? That took me half an hour. So really hard to write good Riddler stuff,
and it shows because there aren't that many great Riddler stories.
There's a really good one from Batman Adventures Volume 2, the Dan Slott, Ty Templeton run, about the Riddler, like, post-reform. That's really, you know, somebody's trying to kill the Riddler after he reforms. That's really, really good. But other than that, animated series episodes and 66 episodes. Like, the Riddler episodes are some of the best 66 episodes, so...
Yeah, but even then, only... I don't know, a third of the Batman the Animated Series Riddler episodes are really good. The one where Batman has to jump in the safe at the end, and the Riddler doesn't know how he survived. I think that's probably the best of them. And it's too bad that I don't remember the title of that one. The Riddler's just hard. He's just hard to get right. And it's too bad that there aren't more great Riddler stories, because he is such a great character.
Yeah, I do not begrudge anyone for not jumping right into the Riddler.
I think some of the best Riddler stories, and mentioning the Paul Dini run on Detective, involve, or like post-reform Riddler, involve him not necessarily clashing with Batman, more as like a friendly rival to Batman. Because then you don't have to have them, you know, have that battle of wits. They just have to try to figure out something faster than the other one, you know?
Yeah, like, I love the way that Dini plays him in that run as being, like just not quite smart enough. Like, he always goes for the red herring solution, right? Like, Batman is willing to do... And it's not even played as it being, like, a failure of his intelligence as much as it's being, like, you know, Batman's willing to put the work in. Like, Batman doesn't stop when he thinks he's got the right answer.
Well, I think the implication is that the Riddler relies too much on his natural intelligence instead of kind of putting boots on the ground, right? Instead of shoe leather. You know what I mean? That's all we got for you. I'm sorry that we don't have more stories to give you. Just don't go read the worst Riddler story or one of the worst Riddler stories. Hush. All right. That is going to do it for this episode of War Rocket Ajax.
Oh, wait, Matt, we got one more thing to talk about real quick.
Hit me.
People, I'm sure, have been waiting the entire episode for this. Matt, as you might have heard, we got some Iron Man information wrong.
Yes. We'll acknowledge it here, and we'll correct it on the next Every Story Ever special. We confused Armor Wars 1 with another story.
Yeah, apparently I confused Armor Wars 2 with Armor Wars 1, and Armor Wars 1 with the story in Iron Man 200. And then I have no idea what Armor Wars 2 is, except that I know I've read it and love it.
I remember we conflated Armor Wars 2, the actual Armor Wars 2, with Armor Wars 1, I guess, because I went and looked it up and reminded myself of details from Armor Wars 2. So
yeah. And also, there's, to make matters more confusing, there's also a really, really great all-ages story. I don't remember who drew it, but Joe Caramagna wrote it in that time where Marvel was doing kind of those all-ages miniseries that were loosely based on crossovers. Like, there was an Infinity Gauntlet one that Clevenger wrote that was just called Iron Man : Armor Wars. That's about Iron Man fighting all the armor villains. So I'm sure I got it confused with that as well. So
okay, we'll correct it. We'll correct it.
We'll be corrected in the future
on the next Every Story Ever special. Please hold us to that. For more about Every Story Ever, you can check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is also where you can stream the show, read show notes, download episodes, and leave comments. If you want to send us an email, you can do that at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is where you can send Every Story Ever lists, World Heavyweight Champions lists. We're doing those, maybe one or two of more of those before the end of the year, so get those in fast. Also, check us out on Tumblr. That is where you can send listener questions. You can do that at warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. Check us out on iTunes. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes, because the more positive reviews we get, the more we are featured there, which is great. And now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to all my stuff. Chris, where can everybody find your stuff?
Everybody can find all of my stuff by going to about.me/ChrisSims. It's all there for you. Links to everything that I do, including the comics that I have written on Comixology.
And that's it, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode.
And until then, keep your mind on Sailor Biz... Wait, no. Wait. What do I say at the end of this show?
See you next week, everybody.
See you next week, everybody.
Yeah! Flash.
I did not mean to do that as a musical thing. I just dropped my pen.
You know what they say is every podcast needs a lot of air. You gotta get as much air into it. Makes, I mean, I'll tell you this, it makes the guests feel comfortable.
We like to let things breathe, Tom. We like to let points breathe.
That was great. What just happened?
Yeah, that was a good one.
There's some good air there.
Both of us getting started and then backing off immediately.
There's going to be a great stinger at the end of this one with all our dead air moments.